I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Audio Football Club, in association with Tag Heuer. The official timekeeper of the Premier League.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, David De Gea is sensational as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wins his biggest game so far as Manchester United manager. Arsenal don't know what to do with Mesut Ozil, and Fulham are just about as unlucky as it's possible to be at Turf Moor. It's transfer window time, and we take a look at Marco Arnautovic's potential big money mega move to China, and whether Christian Pulisic is the new Eden Hazard or a cunning ploy for better brand awareness in the key revenue markets of North America. Romantic. Plus, a whistle-stop tour around Europe, including reaction to Ramsey's relocation to Turin, and JJ Ball has nothing but good things to say about Chris Hughton, but quite frankly, who doesn't? Let's take you now into the audio recording facility, where I'm joined by our star striker back after a brief but grueling summer training camp on a Mexican beach. It's Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
I'm barely human.
Oh, come
I'm
on.
Happy to be here.
Not well rested.
I am not at all well rested. It turns out that I was there during a festival, Sound Tulum. I don't even understand music. I still listen to 80s stuff. So I was just like the wrong place to be. I got in last night and I am somewhat shattered, but happy to be here.
Good. Glad to hear it, Mina. Also, back in the seat he has made his own for 2 weeks in a row. It's our workmanlike midfield general, the boy wonder, Sam Dean. What's going on, Sam?
I'm feeling it. Increasingly awkward at the boy wonder moniker.
But I
quite like the fact that I'm now taking over from Matt Law. I'm trying to sort of make that a thing.
Yeah, I'm sure Matt Law will be delighted to hear that. Finally, it's the tactically astute roaming fullback who Pep Guardiola loves putting an arm around and whispering intensely into his ear. It's JJ Ball.
A fullback?
Yeah.
No.
That's the best position in football.
It is
currently.
Not. It's the one I can't play. I can't do fullback.
Well, Pep will make you do it, JJ, and you'll be happy doing it.
God, you'll be just mesmerised by his talk. Oh, my God, just imagine that blackboard.
Let's not get into Pep straight off the bat. Instead, let's focus on Spurs versus Manchester United. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, first of all, he got Manchester United scoring. Does this game and this result prove he can organise a defence as well, Mina?
No.
Oh.
It's not that I don't think he can. I thought that they were well organised. I thought they were very impressive, to be honest. This was the match that everyone was like, oh, well, this is going to show us whether or not this Manchester United really are changed, because they've had easy matchups until now. But for me, it was a case of, in the first half, Spurs were just bad tactically. They had left lots of spaces in the wide areas, which just became so easy for United to exploit. But in terms of defending, once Spurs adjusted tactically in the second half, it was all about De Gea, and your goalkeeper doesn't need to be that important if your actual defence was very, very good, in my opinion. It was a case of they all positioned themselves rather well at times for United, but it was a little, it wasn't proactive enough. They were just standing in front of the person who had the ball, but they weren't doing enough to try to take the ball, to intercept, to tackle, to actually stop the avenues and cut out the passes into the likes of Harry Kane or whomever it was at Spurs. So for me, it was like, yes, they were defending. I mean, they were well positioned, but I didn't think they were proactive enough. I think it needed a little bit more. Had Spurs had their shooting boots on, they would have possibly scored two or three, and had De Gea not been at the back, I don't know what would have happened. But either way, it was good for United, a good match.
What about De Gea, though, Sam? Is he the same to United as what Fernandinho is to Manchester City? That is to say, just completely irreplaceable. You can't imagine them being anything like as good without him in the team.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. I think I saw sort of the response to some of his saves were, well, they're all quite savable. I think that's sort of a fairish point, that there were no absolute worldy saves in there. Like, they were all sort of on their own. You could see why he said the finishing wasn't great, but the sheer volume of the saves and the sheer amount of times he just pulled his team out there.
Did you see the Ben Foster tweet as well, though, where he said the important thing about De Gea, which you probably don't realise unless you're a goalkeeper, is half the battle is actually being in the position to make those saves quite comfortably.
Mm. And I also like the way how every time he saves it with his feet or whatever, he either holds it or the ball goes miles. Like, if he saves it with his feet, he clears the penalty area at least, and it's going 30 yards away. There's never any sort of chance of a rebound or a sort of scrappy finish afterwards. He always gets rid of the ball and ends the action, I think, as Pep would describe it.
Because he does it with his feet as well, because strikers are always trained to, or coached to, shoot low. I suppose a goalkeeper has to get down, so because they're standing up, it's harder to get down than it is just to go at head height. So all those shots were going low, and he was saving them with his feet, which no other keeper really seems to do. It's always like when you're playing even at like five-a-side level, something like that, when there's a goalkeeper who keeps stopping everything, you start thinking, like, how am I ever going to score against this guy? And then you start trying a bit harder, so you start hitting it a bit harder, or you just forget what you're doing because you're thinking too much, like, how are you going to catch him out or do something like that? That must be happening as well when you're playing against a goalie who's getting everything away.
Did you see on Match of the Day how they showed you Hugo Lloris and in comparison to De Gea, and how they were both lined up? And I think that's what it is that's so different about De Gea, is he always knows how to position himself.
How were they lined up, Mina? Explain for those of us who did not watch Match of the Day too.
So basically it was a case of, you know, there was two exact shots. One didn't, obviously it didn't work out for Spurs, in the sense that De Gea was placed inside the goal. So when the cross came in the same direction that Rashford delivered his pass, it didn't go in and it was saved because De Gea had moved just a little bit inside of the goal so that the near post was also next to him, and he was a little bit out there so that he it had to hit him as opposed to anywhere else. Whereas with Hugo Lloris, he was now outside of the goal posts, and which allowed Rashford to go around him and do a diagonal pass into the goal. And it's just a question of, honestly, centimetres, and that's the difference between a goal being scored for United and a goal being saved by De Gea.
There was at least one, though, the Dele Alli one, when he ran through. I mean, he should have scored that, and that was...
Should have gone bottom left, was it?
Yeah, exactly. Just put that straight down the middle.
I bet he knows it now, though, because you do that, and as soon as you've hit it, you've gone, I've just done everything right, but I've not concentrated enough energy on the final... Like,
do you think it becomes psychological after a while, that you're just thinking, I can't get over this guy? So
maybe, but sometimes they just hit it and it goes in. But that kind of, the exact thing I'm thinking of with that Dele Alli shot, you can see that he looks up to the sky, he's like, he knows exactly what he's done, because he's just not, I think he just hasn't properly processed what he's doing at the very last action, which maybe you don't do when you're a bit older or something, I don't know.
Can I, just to rebuttal Mina's absolute... derisory attempt to criticise Solskjaer.
No, I wasn't.
The first half, that was a proper tactical job. Lingard playing in a sort of false nine.
No, I thought it was fantastic.
Rashford and Martial running off. That was, I mean, we've seen with Solskjaer that we've seen the power, we spoke about this last week, the power of psychology, that he's had impact on the mentality and the mood around Old Trafford since he came in. But this was the first time he really showed a real tactical sort of brain, I think, and by putting Lingard in that false nine, that created the goal, that stopped Harry Winks getting the ball out for Spurs, and that led to that first half of dominance.
That was it,
United, I think.
I wonder how much Mike Phelan had a point in that as well, because I previewed this, did a tactical preview, looked at it, and all the space for Man United to attack was behind the fullbacks, because they go wide, because Spurs play through the middle, because they play a 4-4-2 diamond, so it's all very through the middle. But what United did, with they had the two wide forwards, has been talked about a lot, but you had Rashford and Sam's just drank too much water. Are you okay? So what Man United were doing before Sam drank all his water the wrong way was they had two strikers, but they were playing out wide in the channel, so they were trying to get close to those fullbacks to attack that space. But like Sam was saying, Winks, when you look at Spurs' passing maps, it goes between the centre-backs to Winks as the six, the defensive midfielder who drops deep to link them. And if you do that, if you go and mark Winks out of it, it means that they can't get the ball forward as they normally would. So it totally disrupts their play, and they weren't able to do anything that first half. They could barely get into it. I mean, they had the offside goal that Kane scored, but they weren't really in the game the first half.
I thought it was a great tactical first half by them. I also think that I can't help but blame Pochettino a little bit. He is very narrow, and he should have known that, considering how United, you know, the kind of players that they have and the pace that they do have, it was easy to just prepare for that match in the sense that you knew, just use the channels as much as possible. Obviously, also, when the ball came, I thought Jesse Lingard had been amazing up until that point, but it helped that Sissoko that had been taken off with an injury just before that. And they'd lost something in midfield, a little bit of strength in their midfield to stop that action, and perhaps added a little bit more defensive strength in the middle. So all in all, though, but once... The thing is what he did, though, is he made the side go all out attack for an hour and then hope to God that by the time that all their energy had finished off, De Gea would come in, or there'd be enough for them to see it through. It's just that it's a great tactic, and it worked for them on this occasion. But I'm not sure... I mean, you play that game 9 out of 10 times, and how many times do you end up with just a 1-0?
I think Spurs win that most times, because XG says it as well. It was 2-1.
Exactly.
But as well, United was... I don't think they were all out of attack. I think they were just doing a really clever counter-attack. They need to keep that United way, like Solskjaer was saying after the game, where you flow forward with wingers and pace and you attack. But they only had, I think it's, what's it, 38% or 39% or whatever possession. They're clearly trying to sit and wait and break on them. Yeah.
Sensible, though, isn't it, going into a game like
that?
It's
exactly the
first real test. What more would you need to see from Solskjaer if you were Ed Woodward between now and the end of the season to convince you that he's the man to do the job?
I mean, I don't know. In Real Madrid, the one thing that they said is that they don't necessarily need a tactician, but just somebody who knows how to manage a dressing room. Sometimes when you have a big team and a lot of egos in a room, or United has that reputation, much like Real Madrid. It's a big club.
Do you think he could be like Zidane, where it's just he's a good fit for the club, he understands the club, and there's that affinity which gets you kind of...
If you're happy, you just score goals. That's it. You know, if you're happy, I just feel like it all comes together. And really, he's making the most of what he has at the moment. They do have problems. Defensively, I don't think this is a team that can afford to be the way that it is. I still think Victor Lindelof, lost Dele Alli on one of the... He's just not the greatest defender that you're ever going to have. And he's making do, and he's doing well. He's a guy who's made sure that they're all happy again.
Let's move across to a different part of London, to West Ham, where you were on Saturday, Sam. Arsenal beaten away from home. Let's start with Ozil. What's going on there, Sam? Not even in the squad.
This is becoming, I think, an increasing problem, really, and a bit of a sideshow for Arsenal. I'm not sure that's quite what Unai Emery wants to gain out of this. I think it's increasingly clear now that he doesn't want Ozil at the club anymore. I mean, Ozil is a huge drain on finances, and he's causing all sorts of long-term problems structurally simply by being on those wages. And it's quite clear that Emery doesn't fancy him in his team. The issue is that I think for the first time, really, on Saturday, Arsenal really missed Ozil. There were a lot of occasions when they got into good positions to play that final pass, which is the one thing that Ozil, you can't argue with him on that. That is the one thing he provides more than anyone else and provides better than anyone else. And that was really missing, and that was really obvious. And Socrates said the same after the game, that we missed that last pass. I mean, he didn't say we missed Ozil. He said we missed that final pass. But that obviously affects Ozil. And you look at it and think, I don't really see a way out of this situation unless Ozil adapts to Emery's way of playing or training or Emery's methods, whatever he's not doing that Emery's not happy with. But it's been...
What do you think that is?
Well, he said right at the start of the season, Emery said, Ozil's not... Ozil needs to run like the rest of them and press like the rest of them. And his whole sort of system is based on that high-pressing, high-intensity game, and all very structured, and everything sort of fits into place. And Ozil, notoriously, is a more mercurial, individualist sort of player. He needs to fit into the team method. But it's been about 2 months now since Ozil first got dropped, and that was the away game at Bournemouth. And they've not won an away game since then. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily because Ozil's not been there, but it's clear that making this stand against Ozil hasn't really helped Arsenal. They've not got better since he's done that. I understand the thinking behind it, and I think it would be very much in Arsenal's interest for Ozil to leave the club. But I can't see that happening, because simply, who's going to pay that much money to a 30-year-old who's clearly on the wane?
It seemed like he was a big part of why they were doing so well at the beginning of the season. In a system like Emery's, can't you just carry someone like that? Like, a player that good, can't you just sort of have a rule where, like, well, he's not going to press like the rest of them, but it's all right for what he gives us?
Yeah, listen, Real Madrid couldn't carry him. And this is Real Madrid that had the most fantastic team back then. And Carlo Ancelotti came in, and at the time he was asked, Di Maria or Mesut Ozil, one of them has to be sold. And he sold Mesut Ozil, despite the fact that he said that he actually probably is a better player in terms of technical quality. But he said in terms of character and dynamism and who helps out the team more, who's willing to fill in the gaps and help the squad, I prefer Di Maria. And that was it. Ozil was sold to Arsenal. So this is something that he needs to look at, because this is the second club now and another coach who thinks that he doesn't have the character or the ability to provide for the team. And you can't just be nowadays, it's too much of a luxury to have a player there that has all the talent but isn't really helping the rest of the side, unless you're Ronaldo or Messi, who's scoring like a ridiculous number of goals.
The one thing that Emery has been, and you can't argue, he's been really bold since he came to Arsenal. I mean, one of his first acts was basically to tell Jack Wilshere, you're not good enough, get out. And he was the longest serving midfielder, the fan favourite. That was a big call. Similar call was made on Aaron Ramsey a few months later. And he's been really bold with his changes in matches and off the pitch as well, in training, in just everything he's done. He's basically backed himself and made big decisions, which I think is what Arsenal really needed, particularly in the post-Wenger era. Someone who had the balls to do that. The issue is, and Emery, I think you could admire the way he says, I don't care what Ozil earns. I don't care what anyone earns. They're all the same for me. Every player's the same. It's just what you can provide for the team. I admire that. I think that's a good thing to do. But the issue is that what Ozil earns is a major factor behind this whole situation, that it's Ozil that causes the financial strain that means they can't give Ramsey a new contract for the money that Ramsey wants. It's Ozil that partly, not entirely, means that they can't buy anyone this January. Ozil's salary is a big factor behind the whole underlying problems for Arsenal. So yes, you can say he can't play in the team because he's not good enough as a player, but that has long, wide-reaching sort of complications and implications.
Is Ozil pals with the first team? Like, is he actually good friends that you know of with any of the players in the squad to the point it could cause a problem?
I think there's no suggestion that he's unpopular or disliked by anyone at the club. No, he seems like he's not the kind of guy to throw his toys at the pram and ruffle feathers and be a really disruptive presence. I think he's quite quiet. He's quite sort of quiet, introverted character.
Very rich, introverted character.
A very wealthy, introverted character, yeah. But it's interesting because where could he go, realistically? And where would he want to go? I mean, China would probably pay him the money he's getting, but does he want to go there? Why would you?
I feel like an Italian club might want to go in for him, but it's got to be one of the ones that are willing to pay this kind of money. Yeah. Unless he's... But where's Mkhitaryan?
He's injured.
Right, because there's such a lack of creativity, like you said, in midfield.
Mm. That was the problem. And
Mkhitaryan's the same for me. That's all he doesn't do. And he's not very good at the defensive side of the game.
Mm.
He doesn't. I don't think his positioning's very good when he's trying to get back to defend when they're doing the high pressing bit. And you can't have both of them in the team. It's a nightmare. Ramsey's pretty terrible for it as well. But he also runs forward and leaves position. So his positional discipline is probably what Emery doesn't like very much about him. And I can't speak for Emery, but you saw when he came on, he was just charging forward the whole time. You can't play him in a three. If he's the 10, then he just nips on next to the striker and you're missing someone in that position as well.
Don't tell me these things again.
We'll get into the potential implications of him playing at Juventus a little bit later on. What about West Ham, JJ? Declan Rice looks a real talent.
He's a good little player, Declan Rice. He's sort of built like a defender, but he plays in that the hole just between the midfield and the defence. Really tidy. His first pass is always neat, keeps it going. So when West Ham lose possession, he's back there to help them out. But when they win it back, he always plays that nice little first ball that makes them be able to build their attacks again. He scored his first goal for the club. It was a nice finish. Came about from a corner, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah.
I thought West Ham were okay, but they just don't have as good players as other clubs, so they'll probably finish just below them.
What about Nasri, Sam? How did he look?
Nasri was really good.
Second debut in England.
He's
getting the gang back together, isn't he? Pellegrini. Balotelli next.
Imagine that. Replace Arnautovic.
Balotelli feels like quite a West Ham signing.
That would be a lot of fun. But no, if you look at their team, they had Antonio, Anderson, Nasri and Arnautovic all starting against the big six team. Like, Pellegrini's really going for it. Like, he really likes this attacking way of playing, and he's got these attacking players who play some really nice stuff. And I think I think West Ham, on paper, and when they play their best, you know, the seventh best team, and they are the best of the rest beneath the big six, I think.
It's got a nice balance now as well, especially with Rice. I mean, all the difference having it there.
How does it feel in the stadium there now? Is there any sense that they've kind of got over the weirdness of it, the fans seeing behind the team? Is the atmosphere any better? Because it is noisy there. When they score, it's a very different noise to what it sounds like at Upton Park.
But personally, I still find it quite flat.
Is that because the press seats are terrible there?
They are really far away from the pitch, which is quite annoying. And you have to take an elevator up to them, which is a real pain.
An elevator?
Yeah, it's a pain.
We call it a lift here, mate.
Warnock's here.
No, it was actually David Sullivan. Yeah. Let's move on to the rest of the Premier League. Liverpool back to winning ways. Back to winning ugly at Brighton. Given that Liverpool were coming off that two-game losing streak, would you like to have seen a little bit more attacking from Chris Hughton's team, Mina?
Yeah, I mean, playing sort of they were sitting deep in a 4-5-1 formation. It was just like, this is the chance to really go for it, especially considering that they have a centre-back missing and they had to play Fabinho in there, who, by the way, did a great job except for that wobble in the beginning. I mean, putting him in there, why not apply as much pressure? And they did apply a little bit of pressure on him, but I just felt like they were very cautious in the way that they attacked. I think Glenn Murray at the time had just 7 touches of the ball in the first half. And you're thinking, you need to get the ball to him as quickly as possible. You need to try to shake the side that is at the moment sort of suffering a little bit psychologically after 2 losses. So why not go for it? But I did also think Liverpool played a very mature game. I thought that they showed us that despite that wobble, despite the defeat, they are still a side that are to be reckoned with. They are still composed and know how to force a win.
We saw, didn't we, at the start of the season how they'd sort of, they were grinding out 1-0s quite often, and they were sort of defensive first, then, you know, attacking later. But, and then in December, that sort of changed and they sort of came back to our free-flowing Liverpool and everyone was very excited again. I think it makes sense, and it's probably a good sign that they can, when needed, you know, when having lost 2 games and the pressure's on a bit, they sort of reverted back to, right, let's first and foremost be solid and we can trust Salah to do something further forward. And I think that the fact that they have that now, I mean, there's so much to be said about this already, but the fact that they have that capability now is why they are where they are.
Pressure certainly on Man City playing second. They play Wolves on Monday night. Wolves proven themselves in the past of beating big teams. Do you think they'll cause a mild upset against City on Monday night, JJ?
Absolutely could. It's they've got some very good players as well. They've got a good midfield. They play that different shape. I wonder what shape Guardiola will play against them, because he tends to adapt when he's playing against, and Wolves are always a 3-4-3. It's just hard to predict. Like, I have no idea what's going to happen, because by tomorrow, this was recorded on a Monday, obviously tomorrow, I could say that Man City are going to win this 4-0 and then they draw 2-2 or something like that.
I will press you for a prediction now, George.
Well, I'm not going to give you one. And there's a... the other thing as well, I've totally forgot my point.
Wolves have either drawn or beaten each a member of the Big Six. I know Liverpool's in the FA Cup, but that's, you know, they are the giant killers supreme this season. I think
they drew with City.
At Molineux right in the start of the season, and I think it's because they seem to be better when they've got space to run into, and Neves can spray his 50-yard passes in behind defence.
Yeah, he's been great. As well as we're going to see, is that Liverpool have won that game against Brighton. That's the gap back to 7 points. I know it's just for one day, but it must make a bit of a difference, because it looks 7 looks so much bigger than 4.
Yeah,
so when you're taking them on, you're like, if we lose this, we are really goosed. But if you win, you're close to, you know, 4 points is close to it.
But they've proved Man City, at least in that match against Liverpool, because I obviously haven't been on after that.
Oh yeah, we can talk about that, did we?
No, I thought that was a really amazing performance. Sorry, what did you say?
We didn't get a chance to talk about that.
No, I know. Mm. It's a shame, actually.
It might be for the best.
Because you could have gloated all your way through.
I'm not gloating.
But I thought that they had actually done a great job. So perhaps they can go all out for the win, even if it means sacrificing their style at times.
2 own goals against Fulham, 0 shots on target for Burnley, who beat them. Is this the stench of doomed relegation wafting over the Thames into the poshest part of London? Have you seen any real improvement under Ranieri, Sam?
No. I mean, defensively, they are more solid than they were, and they are shipping less goals, but I think that's hurt them going further forward, and they seem to have less creativity, less sort of ideas. And you just look at that team, and the issue with hiring Ranieri in the first place, and I don't think I've ever said this on the podcast. If I have before, then shut me up. But that squad has been built by Jukanovic, built for Jukanovic, not by Jukanovic at all, built for Jukanovic to play a certain style of passing, attractive, possession-based football. To then hire a manager whose idea of football is completely different doesn't make a huge amount of sense to me, because he's now getting players who are good at doing one thing to try and do something completely the opposite. And I think when the players have said that it's easier to go the other ways and to learn how to be solid than build, but it doesn't strike me as sort of joined up thinking. And Tony Khan's now promised to make more signings in January. I think, well, I'm not sure actually making more signings is a solution here. They sort of made too many. Well, they definitely made too many in the summer. So sort of throwing more sort of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. And this doesn't seem like a particularly good idea to me.
It's panic strategy. And then what happens after they do okay after the signings come in, and then they realise that style of football only really keeps you about 16th, 15th, 14th. so now we're going to go and try and be possession again. Right, and you've got all counter-attack players. This goes around in circles.
I speak from bitter QPR-based experience about this, but if you keep changing manager, and each manager inevitably has a slightly different style from the last, unless you're crazy disciplined like Southampton used to be about wanting to play a certain style, having an identity that runs through the whole club, you just end up with these layers and layers of players in your squad who've been brought in to do a certain thing. And it's a fast track to financial ruin as well, if you might be in danger of going down, as Fulham look like they might be.
Someone like Tom Kearney, for example, who was the club captain, and last year he was like the absolute key to them being good after Christmas and brilliant after Christmas, and they went on that long unbeaten run, one of the playoffs. He scored the winning goal in the playoff final, and he is like the absolute, he's your sort of David Silva type, controlling everything, dictating the whole play. And he didn't start against Burnley. I mean, he's got to the stage now where he's sort of in and out of the team because he's not that relevant, because they're not playing that way anymore.
He's too slow in possession. He doesn't release it quick enough. And Ranieri's all about transitions, quick transitions forward, vertical passes. And that player doesn't suit it.
He's your best player. You're not playing to his strengths. I just find it baffling.
This is what's annoying about Ranieri, is he doesn't tend to adapt to what players he has. He has a style and he tries to enforce that style. And it works a lot of times, but sometimes if he does have a team that have a different set of skills, I think it takes skill to actually adapt to the players you have, and that's something he doesn't do very well.
What do you think of Watford, Mina? They are seventh, similar to West Ham, a club having a pretty good season, slightly under the radar. Can they keep it going?
They have good enough players. I don't think that they make the most of the chances that they do create. This is the thing. I think they will be there and thereabouts, because I think their players are good enough and better than most of what they are facing. But the team that I think has really changed is Southampton under Hasenhüttl. I think that game yesterday showed us just how much. It's not that they are playing fantastic football or they are a side now that are difficult to beat, but what's interesting about them is how much they're interested in actually closing down the opponent, getting to the ball, trying to make something work. It's that ambition and courage made all the difference to them.
Despite the defeat to Leicester, you thought Claude Puel deserved a little bit of credit over the weekend, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I fully understand why there is quite a lot of unrest now and unhappiness.
Unrest that an old lady has taken a very small banner saying Puel out, please, possibly at the bottom of it, and had it confiscated.
Yeah. I don't understand that, though.
They're really struggling to break down teams who come and just sit deep at the King Power. So they've lost a lot of games against teams that they really shouldn't be losing to. And I think this stylistically, I think the fans aren't particularly thrilled by the attempts to play more sort of steady build-up and possession-based play. And obviously saying that also applies to players. I mean, Jamie Vardy said himself, it doesn't suit me. And obviously for the fans, that they have such great memories of Vardy running in behind teams on the counter-attack that they really want to maintain that. But I think Puel, I think, deserves credit for, even when the pressure's getting stronger and stronger, he's sort of maintaining his faith in young English players. I think, how often have we seen a manager decide, right, okay, long-term thinking goes out the window, I've just got to win this game to keep my job, and he's really not doing that. I mean, this weekend they had in the second half, after half time, they had five players who are all English who are 22 or younger in the team, which I think, you know, no other manager in the league is giving that sort of opportunity to young players and helping or trying that hard to build a squad based around young English talent. And I'm sure in 4 or 5 years time, when Puel, I'm sure, won't be there, they'll look back at this sort of era and think, well, actually, that was quite an important transition for our club.
That's the thing, because they can't afford to buy these players to take them to the next level, but these players definitely could. Ndidi could easily play in a top six Premier League team, in a Champions League team, and you've got Chilwell at left back, which is going to be one of the best in Europe.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Like, easily. You've got Ricardo Pereira at right back. He's young as well. Chowdhury, I'm not too sure about what his level's going to be at, but you've got all these players that together are growing up as a team, and given 2-3 years, like, they could be really, really tidy. But then you can't. Puel has the chance now to build them there and get, you know, build that thing so they develop into these stars. Hopefully they don't get poached and bought for £40 million each. But that's how you do it. That's the only solution that they've got, is to buy these young players and turn them into that.
I think that's why they should support him.
What about Rio Ferdinand, Mina? Are you going to come to his defence? He took a lot of criticism for what he said about Mike Ashley at the weekend. Newcastle looking like another transfer window and no investment, lost at Chelsea quite predictably. But Rio Ferdinand said, actually, Mike Ashley deserves a bit more credit. Newcastle fans should be happy. Did you think he had a point?
The thing is, right, is that I'm not one of those people that thinks you have to spend lots of money in order to make your club better. I don't think Mike Ashley's been great, though, so I'm a bit in between her. What do you guys think? I honestly don't know.
I think it's a complicated one. So, now it looks terrible. Mm. When he came in, so a lot of it you have to put through a Mike Ashley filter. But when he came in and bought the club, he had to put at least 100 million of his own money in just to keep it afloat because it was in real trouble the way it had been run before, and they were spending money based on future earnings to the point where they had no future earnings they could base any money on. So they were in real trouble. But then I agree with Mina, you don't need to spend money to build your club, but at the same time you still need to develop and get bigger. There's no one really coming through. They played like Sean Longstaff, I think his name came on and played on the weekend because Shelby was suspended, did okay. But then if you look at Leicester, for example, spent 20 million was it on Madison from Norwich, and that's the kind of player that, I mean, Newcastle's record signing is still Michael Owen, which is 16 million. Shearer was 15 million before that. They've never really got close. So if they're not investing anywhere, I mean, you'd see like DeAndre Yedlin was a nightmare all game, just getting torn apart at right back against Chelsea. And then you've got Christian Atsu, who is amazing at everything except shooting, passing, or crossing. But that's the thing.
So everything, basically.
Well, but that's the thing. Like, he's a good footballer. If you played him at five-a-side, you'd be like, oh, who the hell is this guy? He's unbelievable. But on 11's pitch, he's rapid. He gets from front to back. He seems to be in the right place at the right time. You know, his movement is good. His dribbling is good. But then his final, I keep saying action, I sound like I'm a professor of tactics or something. But his final action is always bad. There is a cross at the end when he's just trying to put a ball, hook it in with his left foot. He's left-footed into the box. And all the players just go straight for a goal kick. And they'll turn and look at him like, what the hell are you doing? Because he must be better than that.
I think that's really well said. You know, and the fact is that you don't need lots of money to build a side or to make a good club or to actually win even. But it's the fact that he hasn't run it properly. He hasn't put a scouting network in place. He hasn't developed or invested in youth that he can build up to push Newcastle forward in the next few years. It's the inner workings of the club that just don't seem to work at the moment. And you've got Rafa Benitez just trying to do a rescue job. I think that's the biggest problem that you have with him. It's not necessary to spend 40 and 50 million on players, but it is necessary to make sure the club in its core is working on every level.
Whose side are you on, Sam? Team Rio or team entire population of Newcastle?
Very much team entire population of Newcastle. I mean, Mike Ashley promised to spend, and this is a quote, you know, every penny generated by the club to spend on transfers. He hasn't done that. He's broken that promise. You know, Luke Edwards is our man in the northeast. He knows better than anyone this kind of problem. But, I mean, he made the point quite strongly in a good way to Rio on Twitter that Newcastle win profit over the transfer window. Like, look at clubs like Brighton spending like 75 million on players. Clubs like Huddersfield are spending more money than Newcastle. Cardiff spending more money
than
Newcastle.
But is that smart? Is that smart when they're just spending lots of money? What are they doing that's amazing at the moment?
That's additional money to their budget, isn't it?
They're improving their playing squad. It's not just, you know, you don't need to spend to win, but you need to spend to keep up everyone else's spending money. I mean, there's so much TV money coming in. A club like Brighton can splash out a lot of money on a lot of players. As Newcastle, you have to keep up with them, otherwise you're going to get relegated again. That's just like, they're just lucky that they've got Benitez there, who is making the absolute best of a squad that is, you know, mid-table championship at best, I think.
Take that, Newcastle United, but thank God for Rafa Benitez.
You're listening to the Telegraph Audio Football Club, part of the Telegraph Podcasting Network. To find more of our podcasts, just go to telegraph.co.uk/podcasts.
Let's move on to the glamorous world of football transfers. We saw a good goal from Willian at the weekend. He's 30 now. Chelsea often quite ruthless when they're with their older players. They move them on quite eagerly. But it's easy to understand why they might want to keep him around despite apparent interest from Barcelona.
After you, Mina, go ahead.
No, I think it's a terrible strategy to get rid of everyone over 30. I don't understand it because I really do think that at certain points your team needs to be a fine balance between experience, and there are some players who perhaps lose something on an athletic level when they age, but they gain something on a mental level, on an understanding of the game, on a positional sense. So I think this ruthless way that they're going about anyone who's over 30, you don't need just young athletes. Sometimes you just need someone who thinks better than the rest. Look at Sergio Busquets. How old is he? Actually, he's probably not that old. But you always have to have a fine balance of youth and older players, ones who can train the squad, ones who create harmony in the dressing room. You always need a likes of Iniesta, as well as, Ousmane Dembele, a fine mix. And I just don't get why they have this strategy.
What about Marko Arnautovic, linked heavily with a move to China for loads and loads of money? Would you go? I think I would. If I wasn't playing in the country where I was from already and someone said three times your wages, a few years in China, I think I'd say, yes, please.
So I do love my job, but if the China Telegraph came across and said you've got 300 grand a week to do the same thing you're doing...
Can you do some tactical
previews? At a far lower level. Yeah, I mean, I would learn Mandarin.
Imagine how many page views you get. It was so easy to get page views in China compared to the Premier League of British journalism.
But you just do it for a year and you earn heaps and heaps of money. And I mean, it's just a person who has a job, really. It doesn't seem like Marko Arnautovic is particularly in love with football. He's just very, very good at it. I think that's absolutely fine. If he doesn't care about trying to win titles or cement some sort of legacy and he wants to earn a heap of cash, I mean, do it.
Yeah, that was pretty much what Mark Noble said afterward. He basically said, look, if you're getting offered 400 grand a week, that means you don't have to work for the rest of your life and your kids don't either. So why wouldn't you? He's 29 years old on Arnautovic. He's hardly grown up in Austria thinking, I can't wait to play at the London Stadium for West Ham in my older, like... You know.
Yeah. And that age, they're starting to think, what do you do next? Is it punditry? Quite hard to get into, and it's probably a bit of a job. Or you go into coaching? Does he really fancy that? If he's not that fussed about the game, just yeah. Or
how
just
long
chill
is the
out.
Contract in China?
I don't know if it's real contracts being offered yet, is it? There's no confirmation. It's just rumours.
I'm sure there's some sort of agreement with what kind of money he'll be getting, but I don't think it has been.
Is
official.
He happily married?
No. I don't know. Yeah. But he has got kids, though.
All this and more will be revealed next week when we look into Marko Arnautovic's personal life. Let us enjoy
400 grand a week or something.
No, I'll go marry him.
Audio Football Club, in association with Tag Heuer, the official timekeeper of the Premier League. Our timepieces are designed for those who love challenges. Don't Crack Under Pressure is much more than just a claim. It's a state of mind.
Let us enjoy a song for Europe with Mina Rizuki. Mina, what has been the reaction in Turin to Aaron Ramsey's mooted move to Juve?
It's actually been largely positive.
Will he get in the team?
Yeah, I think so, actually. This is the thing. I mean, they want him now because what they've noticed is that, which is something I've said over the summer, is that they have lots of players off the ball that are excellent, but not many on it that can provide, that's something special that they need, which is why Dybala's had to adjust his position, sort of play just behind and try to link up play. You're quite dependent now on Bonucci doing something from the back and Pjanic obviously in midfield. Khedira is no longer the athletic beast that he once was. Emre Can is just a little bit too aggressive for the league, I think. He just always looks like he's looking for a fight, you know? Then you've got like Rodrigo Bentancur, who's amazing, but still a kid. So you sort of do need a player that understands how to move into the box, how to create space. The only thing that worries me about all of this is what was said before, the positional indiscipline. Allegri is very good at developing players and turning them into excellent ones, even if they were somewhat mediocre or not even that great before. And he is all about the team. So Ramsey has got to buy into that. He's got to buy into the fact of sacrificing yourself for the team. And for me, he's a little bit too individualistic. But he's being compared to John Charles as the next Welshman. I mean, it's all about, look at Juventus pulling off another free transfer. But let's just say I'm a little bit hesitant about it all.
What about Christian Pulisic, the biggest move of the transfer window so far, although we won't be seeing him in the Premier League till next season? What sort of player is he going to be for Chelsea? Is he going to be like the new Kevin De Bruyne, but Chelsea-era Kevin De Bruyne, so perhaps not that good? Or is he the new Eden Hazard?
The new Hudson-Odoi.
The new Hudson-Odoi. Yeah.
Well, people are saying that actually his replacement would be Hazard's brother, so... He's a very interesting player. I don't think he's very young, so he's not the finished product yet. He's only 20 years old. He's a man who understands how to take on players. It's not that he's hugely flexible and can play anywhere. He's better suited either behind the striker or on the right. He'll take on his man. He's not a guy who will push the team forward into the final third, but he is someone that will make it work and he'll do something special once you're there. He will always know how to open up play. But I think that his purchase is intelligent for reasons outside of the pitch. He's an American who is born and bred on English football. He is someone that you can use to tap into the American market on that PR strategy level. He's everything. And it's a perfect purchase for them if they want to make sure that their branding gets bigger on a commercial level. They make more money and profit. I think it's a huge investment.
Yeah, the hype around him when he first came into the Dortmund side was sort of suggesting he could be like the best American player of all time, and the commercial ramifications of that would be very, very positive.
Some people say
Chelsea.
He already is the best American player of all time.
That is so harsh.
He smashed on every Landon record. Donovan.
Gattuso had a few interesting things to say about another Chelsea target, Gonzalo Higuain. At the moment, he's our player and we're holding on tightly to him. I don't know what will happen. If it was up to me, I'd keep him at my house and feed him my dinner. Dinner notwithstanding, would he fit well in England, Mina?
I never know how well players adapt to different leagues. There are just some that just don't do as well in one league as Alvaro Morata. I thought he was sensational in Serie A, sensational in La Liga, but it's just been really disappointing, obviously. Salah has just gone and developed into one of the finest players in the world, but he wasn't that in Serie A before that. He was very good, but perhaps definitely not this level. So you never really know how they fit in, but what Higuain does is, obviously, his problem is that he's not the best finisher at times. You've seen how many great chances he's missed when playing for Argentina. He obviously gets blamed a lot for them not winning trophies at times. What he does do is improve the play in final third. Gattuso is a little bit upset because he doesn't seem to be happy in Milan. He was obviously the star in Napoli, then became MVP for Juventus, very much the man that they relied upon. He's come to Milan and he's really suffered. They have a beautiful relationship on a human level, him and Gattuso. They're always hugging and laughing, and he always says that Gattuso is such a great man. And when he finally broke his duck and scored a goal after a run of, 2 months without getting one, he went straight to Gattuso and hugged him. But sadly, I think Gattuso feels a bit a failure on his part on not actually getting the best out of Higuain in the way that Sarri has managed or Allegri. Will he fit into Chelsea? He doesn't have the pace. He's not really the most athletic kind of player, but I do think he's very intelligent. I think he knows how to position himself well to help the rest of the team. And even as a counter-attacking threat, he knows where to put himself so that the ball just runs through him and his teammates can score. I do think he's a great player. I don't think he is sort of the finisher that the likes of Mauro Icardi or even Mo Salah are.
I think I know who I'd rather have dinner with. Lovely three-course Italian special with Gattuso. Not a plate of cigarettes that you get at Maurizio Sarri's house. JJ Bull, yeah. Is that your dossier I can spot on the desk? Do you want to open it up?
Yeah, I can do that if you want, yeah.
Please do.
All right, so it's open. I clicked on it. Hello. So the dossier, which I don't call it. We talked a bit earlier on about Brighton and Liverpool. I think Chris Hughton is one of the most underrated managers in, I'm not going to say the world, in England. He doesn't ever seem to get praise for what he's doing, but he's been excellent for many, many years. He was great at Newcastle. He was unlucky to get dismissed from that job. But against Liverpool, I think that was the exact strategy for teams who... Liverpool are one of the best teams in Europe, if not the world. They have some of the best individual players. They are really hard to play against. So if you have a team like Brighton, who don't have many good players at all, you have to watch your strategy. And what he did, like Mina was saying, is he played a 4-5-1, and they sat behind halfway, and they waited for Liverpool to come out to make sure that they had a bit of a... They were a bit more exposed, they could go. And Hughton was saying that if you try and open up against Liverpool, you'll get torn apart. So the strategy was to keep everything tight and nice and compact and deny them opportunities so they get frustrated. The ball is being forced out wide, so Robertson then get 2v1, so then they have to go back inside and go to the right, and it'd be 2v1 over there, back inside. And they were waiting until the last 15 minutes before they would go for them. If it wasn't for that penalty, I think they would have done it. I think they would have got over the line at 0-0, if not managed to get something on the break. And the other cool thing they were doing was that they had Pascal Gross and Solly March on the right, but they were hitting balls early to the left because they had Lucadi on the left, who was attacking, becoming like an extra striker by coming in. It's just a weird little tactical bit, trying to play against Shaqiri was the right-sided forward for Liverpool, so that means he'd have to track Lucadi, but he wouldn't do that. You'd expect, because he's Shaqiri and that's kind of... And it just made total sense. I think he's really underrated. Brighton are 13th. Now they've got 26 points. Eddie Howe is talked of as the next England manager and everything, and they're just on 12th with 27. He spent a lot more money than Hughton has. Why isn't Hughton getting talked about? There's been a... England or Ireland boss or something.
It's true, actually.
He is now. Finally, after Maurizio Sarri said that his Chelsea side would beat England every time they played, where do we think the national team of England would finish in the Premier League? And this is assuming Gareth Southgate has access to some sort of cloning technology and he'd be able to have all of his players and they'd also still play for their team. So Harry Maguire plays for England and Leicester in the fictional Premier League. We asked our friends on Twitter. Various shouts. The general consensus is that they'd be good, not elite. David Manning, Jamesy and Seb had guesses ranging from 6th to 10th. Eggy said simply above Everton. What do you think, Sam?
I think they'd be pushing for a Champions League place. I think they'd give Chelsea a good game. Yeah, I think man for man, I think that'd be quite... If you were to do a composite 11 of England and Chelsea, I think it'd be quite fairly split.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
This is a team that really struggled to play to score from open play. The England team.
What's your guess, Mina?
Oh, for me, I'd go more 8th to 10th. I think they're good. I don't think there's much fluency in their attacks. So perhaps if they had the same amount of time that Sarri has with Chelsea and, you know, obviously like day in and day out, they could be a different team. But based on what I've seen of them and their run in, I mean, to in the World Cup, then I would say, yeah, they're about a Watford side.
Oh, JJ?
I like that as the judge. I think it probably seems to me, I think it'd be mid-table. But if they have time to work on it, then... This is the thing, because right now, Sam, you see, if you put, the players are half decent. I mean, they're all good, these England players, but they're not managed week in, week out with the same manager with plans to put in place to see how you build and you can change the style of play. So international teams tend to all be counter-attack teams. It's the easiest one to teach very quickly. So it depends on the quality of player you have. I mean, I think they would get done by even Man United now. But, you know, like Liverpool, Man City would absolutely kill them.
I think Wolves would kill them.
Maybe. Imagine the set-piece routines they come up with, though, if Gareth Southgate had weeks and weeks to work on them.
Oh, there must only be so many you can do, though. I don't know.
Well,
they start bringing in, you know, that film Basketball, when they start bringing in psych-outs, they'll have to have that thing in part of the set-pieces.
We will never know. That's your lot for this week. Please contact me on Twitter if you'd like to before next Monday's episode. It's at Tom with an H, Gibbs. Don't forget you can send us an email as well. It's afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. We'll read out the best of what you send us and mention and possibly mispronounce your name. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Search for Telegraph Audio Football Club wherever you get your podcasts. If you have yet to donate 5 of your precious stars to us on Apple Podcasts, please do. Please do it now. Please leave a good review. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Joel Grove on the buttons. And thank you again to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.